Thank you for attending. Before we begin, we ask that cell phones are turned off and those attending will be respectful and attentive. It is the mission of Sunstone to host thoughtful and respectful dialogue. We invite all here to practice looking at all Mormon experiences as legitimate Mormon experiences, no matter how diverse they may be. This session is 1 hour long, and we ask both audience and presenter to keep within the framework of that time so we can end on time. As an airborne platoon sergeant and a college instructor forever, I promise you we will end on time. Please make sure to pick up your belongings as you leave, and we look forward to seeing you bright and early tomorrow. Each morning, the first 50 attendees get a doorbuster prize, so get here early. This session is being recorded, and audio will be available for purchase at the Sunstone Audio Desk after the session. The 4.1 million solar mass black hole at the center of our galaxy, closely surrounded by thousands of typical 25-40 solar mass black holes, I have no idea what that means, but I'm going to learn, is the great one, COLOB, with many great ones near unto it. Recent scientific studies indicate black holes likely involve higher dimensional portals leading out of our universe and into an alternate reality. In addition, I'll back up. It is this sense in which COLOB is nearest to the throne of God. In addition, terms and phrases such as one planet above another, set time, the order of that upon which thou standest, all become clear in terms of relativity. Scientist, engineer, and elder Joseph Callender is author of the Amazon number one bestseller, Faith in Physics, How the Light of Christ Bridges the Gap, and I've ordered my copy. He lives in Santan Valley, Arizona, with his son, Chris, and I give to you Dr. Callender.
Mr. Callender, or just Joe.
Joe. Engineer Joe. All right.
Retired engineer. Folks, you know what? Space ain't nothing. Really. See, Einstein's great insight was that gravity warps space and time. And you can't warp nothingness. So space is
a microphone, so it's not being recorded.
Thank you very much. We need to get you a... that one. They've been moving the mics around again, and I didn't check it. You're going to need it.
Okay, so...
Yeah, do that. It can be adjusted higher.
Stay with.
Okay, it's probably good.
You can hear in the back.
Okay, thank you. What was that?
Go ahead.
All right, so as I was saying, space ain't nothing.
See, I'm on.
Just
got to
get a little bit closer.
You got to get a little bit closer.
Okay, how's this?
Yeah.
I can hear myself now. So as I was saying, space ain't nothing, which means it's a something. See, Einstein's great insight was that gravity warps space and time. And furthermore, there's a portal that leads completely out of our space and time universe into an alternate reality or an alternate universe of some sort. Astronomers have a name for it. It's in the direction of the constellation Sagittarius, just a mere 26 million light years from here. And astronomers call it Sagittarius A star. And so how do I change the, is there a clicker or something?
No, you can do it if you're, you must be.
Oh, yeah. Just hit page down. Oh, there we go. And by the way, Sagittarius A star has another name. In the Book of Abraham, it's called Kolob. I'm assuming most people are familiar with the Book of Abraham here. Okay. So let's start, though, by pretending we don't know that Kolob is Sagittarius A star and see if we can identify it from these scriptures in Abraham and a little knowledge from modern cosmology and relativity. So Abraham 3, verse 2, says, "And I saw the stars, that they were very great, and that one of them was nearest unto the throne of God. And there were many great ones which were near unto it. And the Lord said unto me, These are the governing ones, and the name of the great one is Kolob, because it is near unto me, for I am the Lord thy God. I have set this one to govern all those which belong to the same order as that upon which thou standest." I've underlined five words or phrases here that I think if we can identify or explain each one of these, then we can feel confident that we have identified Kolob. So the great stars, first of all, we need to understand what Abraham means by great stars. So all stars eventually run out of fuel and become one of these three here, either a white dwarf star, which is the fate of our sun, which is a typical star, or if it's a little larger, it will become a neutron star, and if it's larger still, it will become a black hole. So we can assume that what Abraham calls great stars are the black holes, the largest stars. Our sun is 333,000 times as massive as the Earth. That's pretty big. Abraham says the stars are very great. He's absolutely right. And as I said, our sun is a pretty typical star. So stars are powered by nuclear fusion in the core of the star, which produces a great deal of energy and tries to expand the star. But these things are so massive that gravity tries to collapse it down. So it's in an equilibrium condition until it runs out of fuel, at which time it will collapse and become one of these three types of stars. So we can assume that, as I said, that the great stars that Abraham refers to are the largest stars, which are the black holes, or stars that will eventually become black holes. Then there's a class of black holes called supermassive black holes, which are much bigger than your typical black hole, which is 25 to 40 solar masses. And there is one and only one of these supermassive black holes per galaxy, and it's located exactly in the center of the galaxy. And astronomers have named the supermassive black hole in the center of our galaxy Sagittarius A star. And there can be millions or even billions of solar masses in size. So 100,000 times the size of a typical black hole. So now that we understand Abraham's stellar terminology, we can proceed with our list, either the five items that I underlined in verses 2 and 3. We're going to take these one at a time and see if we can identify or explain each one of them. So the great star, as I said, is the SMBH, supermassive black hole, at the center of our galaxy, Sagittarius A star. Every galaxy has one and only one, and ours is 4.1 million solar masses in size. That's 1.4 trillion times the size of the Earth, located exactly in the center, as I said. So Then the second item on the list would be to identify the great stars that are near unto the great star. And I've listed a couple of recent studies here by astrophysicists and astronomers. An article that appeared on astronomy.com.
The one slide behind.
Sorry.
There you go.
Thanks. Thanks for telling me that. So, astronomy.com 2016, the headline of the article was, "Hundreds of black holes congregate surprisingly peacefully in a Milky Way star cluster. A globular cluster is a large ball of stars that orbits the center of a galaxy." And another one, published in 2018 in the journal Nature, and the journal Nature is probably the most prestigious science journal in the world, very difficult to get into. The headline on that one was, "New study suggests tens of thousands of black holes exist in the Milky Way's center." So we've identified so far an enormous great star in exactly in the center of our galaxy that's surrounded by thousands of other great stars. So we have a candidate for CoLab. Third item on the list. How does CoLab slash Sagittarius A star govern whatever it governs? Well, a study published in March of 2017 in the journal Nature by European astronomers found prodigious star generation driven by huge energy output from active galactic centers. And the active galactic center is the supermassive black hole. These things go through periods of, you know, being active and then inactive. So when they're feeding, that is when they're pulling in, you know, a star, let's say, or a gas and dust cloud that passes by, that's when they're active. And when they're active, these things spin. They have poles just like the Earth. And so when they're feeding, there are these enormous jets. You've probably seen pictures of them on the internet or Science Channel or whatever. And so they shoot out these enormous jets of energy, and when they do, they create stars. So they turn star generation on and off in the galaxy. So then another study published in January 2018 by University of California at Santa Cruz scientists, again in the journal Nature, found pretty much the same thing. Quoting from that article, All right. So the observed relation between supermassive black hole mass and star generation efficiency applies to all generations of stars formed throughout the life of the galaxy. So it's the first object that forms in a galaxy, and it, you know, controls star formation in a galaxy. So that's at least one way in which we can say that it governs the galaxy. All right, so then going down the list, item number four is explain the order of that which upon which Abraham stood. Well, since every galaxy has its own supermassive black hole, its own CoLab, so to speak, that governs that galaxy, then obviously the galaxy or the order of that upon which Abraham stood is the Milky Way. It's the stars, planets, and other objects in the Milky Way galaxy. That's what Sagittarius A star governs. So, and then finally, in what way is it nearest to the throne of God? Well, it's a portal to an alternate reality, as I said in the beginning, where the throne of God is located. So this is where we get into general relativity a little bit, but don't worry, we're not good. What's that? Oh, man, thank you for reminding me.
There you go.
So, how's that sound? Yeah. I travel from Arizona, and I always forget something. So I had a laser pointer and did not bring it. But on the left is an illustration from NASA. I downloaded this from their website. It's public domain. It's an illustration of the surface, the two-dimensional surface there represents our three-dimensional reality, our three-dimensional universe. See, according to Einstein and general relativity, gravity warps space and time. So this is meant to illustrate the warping of space due to gravity. So the two-dimensional surface is our three-dimensional reality, and then the dip in the surface there, the depression in the surface, represents the warping of space due to the mass, which in this case is the Earth. And the reason that we show three dimension, we suppress one dimension and show our three-dimensional universe in two dimension is just for ease of illustration, because it's pretty difficult to show the warping of, you know, three-dimensional space, you know, as a three-dimensional object. And pretty soon we're going to get into a higher dimension. We're going to get into the fourth dimension. And that would be just about impossible to show on a, you know, on a two-dimensional screen here or a two-dimensional piece of paper. So anyway, that's the warping of space due to the mass of the Earth. And on the right side there, again, our three-dimensional world is shown as a two-dimensional surface there. And the depression indicates the warping of space due to the mass of the black hole. So when a large star runs out of fuel and collapses, space becomes so warped around the mass of the black hole that there's a certain radius around it in which anything that passes that radius, called the event horizon, anything that passes the event horizon is a goner, you know. It can't get out. Not even light can get out because your space is so warped, or in other words, gravity is so strong in that area. And until recently it was thought that anything that falls into one of these black holes, the reason it's called the black holes is because not even light can escape from it. Right? You can't see it directly and it because it doesn't emit light or reflect light. But it used to be thought that whatever falls into a black hole gets crushed to a point of zero size and infinite density called a singularity. But the most recent studies indicate that that is not what happens, but that it's very likely that what falls into a black hole gets crushed to a very small size, but not zero size, and likely gets ejected out of our universe into some alternate reality. And that's the reason for the road sign, the alternate reality ahead. And you can see the event horizon there shown as a circle. That's actually radius around the black hole. And what's, you know, the ring singularity there, that's what replaces what used to be thought as a singularity. It's actually a ring of finite radius and zero thickness. But anyway, that's black holes are predicted by relativity. And another prediction of relativity is what's now called wormholes. Technically, they're called Einstein-Rosen bridges. So an Einstein-Rosen bridge is a tunnel in the fabric of space-time that's postulated to traverse a higher dimensional space to either a distant location in our universe or completely out of our universe into an alternate reality again of some sort. And the you know, latest studies again indicate that black holes may be associated, very likely are associated, with wormholes, or that they function as a wormhole out of here. Most physicists actually do believe, this is not science fiction, most physicists now do believe that our universe is, our three-dimensional universe is a subset of a higher dimensional universe. So, and you know, the question naturally arises, why don't we see, you know, if there are other dimensions, other, you know, other than the, you know, the three that we're used to and familiar with, why don't we see them? And it used to be thought that it's because they are very tightly curled up, so tightly curled up that we can't see them. But again, most recent studies indicate that, you know, at least one or two of them are probably very large, just like the three dimensions that, that we're used to. And the reason that we don't see them is because our physical senses, our three-dimensional senses, are confined to this three-dimensional subset of a higher reality. String theory, which in recent years has replaced the former theory of elementary particles, in which the particles themselves were considered to be just point objects, you know, with no size themselves. String theory posits that, that the particles are actually extremely tiny, unimaginably small, but not zero size, loops of vibrating energy. And string theory requires a universe of 9 or 10 spatial dimensions. And most physicists now believe that those dimensions do exist. And so on the right here, the image now represents a wormhole. And again, our universe is shown as a two-dimensional surface, the paper. Note that a two-dimensional surface does not have to be flat. It doesn't have to be planar. The surface of the Earth is a two-dimensional surface. You can, well, it's an idealized two-dimensional surface. We can specify any location on the surface of the Earth with two parameters, right? Latitude and longitude. It's a two-dimensional surface. So the paper is a two-dimensional surface. And so if we want to travel, say, from one end of the paper to the other, let's say at one end is Salt Lake City and the other end is Phoenix, we would drive along the surface of the paper and around the bend there to the other side. But if we had a wormhole, we could just jump into the wormhole and take a shortcut. Follow that? Yeah. So, and now notice the pencil is a higher dimensional object than the surface of the paper. If it was a three-dimensional object, we'd have to draw it on the surface of the paper. Right? Because, you know, we're suppressing one dimension. But it's shown perpendicular to the paper. So it represents now an object in the fourth dimension. So we could jump into the, you know, fourth dimension if we could. You know, we'd jump into the fourth dimensional object like a fireman sliding down a firehouse pole. Right? Okay. So next slide shows just another another illustration of a wormhole. You know, I wrote a book. Took me 3.5 years to write the book, and the hardest part of writing the book was drawing this darn thing. So anyway, again, our universe is shown as a two-dimensional surface, and then the wormhole is perpendicular to the two-dimensional surface, and it leads to elsewhere. So it leads to an alternate reality where the throne of, you know, God's throne is located according to the scriptures in Abraham. And according to recent studies, as I said before, black holes are now believed to function as wormholes.
In what way is a wormhole a shortcut in terms of time or what?
Space.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, but that's a good question, though, because, you know, by Einstein's theory, You know, there was space and there was time, and both of them were thought to be fixed and, you know, permanent, and everybody took them for granted. But Einstein showed that space and time are very much related. And so now, you know, the term space-time, one word, has come into use that, you know, indicates that.
So how would the trip from Salt Lake to Phoenix be manifest through a wormhole?
Well, you'd be driving along the surface here, which is just, you know, driving on the roads here, flying or whatever, and then you go into the wormhole, and you come out somewhere else. We can't do this, of course, because we're three-dimensional beings, you know. Now, if we were dead and out of our bodies, yeah, then, you know, no problem, right? So, and we'll talk a little bit more about that shortly. All right, so black holes as portals to an alternate reality is actually a popular idea now among many well-respected physicists, including Nobel laureates. In fact, Stephen Hawking, in a paper that he was working on in 2016 before he died, you know, just, I don't know, maybe a year back or a few months back, I don't think he ever finished the paper before he died. But according to DiscoverMagazine.com, he said in the paper that black holes may offer a route to another universe. And Stephen Hawking, everybody probably knows who Stephen Hawking is, probably he's considered to be probably the foremost expert on black holes in the world. So, you know. And then,
how does Kolob relate to the black hole?
Well,
Kolob
is a black hole.
Okay, Kolob is a black hole, but then does that mean there can be life on something of that magnitude?
Well, no. See, it's a portal out of our three-dimensional universe.
That's what Kolob is?
That's what I'm saying it is, yeah. So, I mean, a lot of very eminent physicists, you know, astrophysicists and so on, believe that these things, that black holes in general, are portals out of our universe. And the supermassive black hole, it's 100,000 times more massive than a typical black hole. It's located right in the center of our galaxy. And it's surrounded by thousands of other black holes, you know, more typical black holes of various sizes, I imagine. So it fits the description in the scriptures here in the book of Abraham of Kolob. So that's what I'm trying to show here as I go through that list of five things that I had underlined in Abraham verses 2 and 3. So, so, and then the only other thing on this slide is in a 2013 study, a couple of physicists found similar results that, you know, and these are only a couple of studies. You know, there are other studies, but I listed a couple of them here just for illustration purposes. All right, so then the question is, has anybody ever seen these higher portals out of our universe? And the answer is, yeah. Joseph Smith saw a conduit open right up into heaven, he said, after Moroni's visit. You know? Moroni went up through this conduit. You know? So that's one thing. And then a 1982 study, a Gallup poll survey, estimated that 13 million Americans had one or more near-death experiences. And they often include the experience of passing through what they describe as a tunnel of sorts. Kind of sounds like a wormhole, doesn't it? And many, you know, mystics and yogis over the centuries have, reported seeing, you know, a higher dimensional phenomenon, you know, by which their visions of God have occurred, you know, and people have near-death experiences. You know, they travel through this tunnel, they meet the being of light, a one who radiates, you know, tremendous light and love, and they usually usually identify this being or this person as Christ. So many people have actually seen this thing, but nobody has actually traveled through bodily, you know, through this portal bodily. If you went into a black hole, of course you'd die, you know. But, you know, I mean, it makes no difference when you're already dead, right? People having near-death experiences, their spirit leaves their body, no problem. You can't kill the spirit. So, yeah, Augustine, you know, St. Augustine in the Catholic Church called it the eye of his soul. Hildegard of Bingen, who was canonized in 2012 by the Catholic Church, called it the gateway of the soul. And Joseph Smith reported a beautiful gate by which people enter the celestial kingdom. So, and as I said, it only needs to be traversable by spirits. You know, we're not going there physically. All right, so that's Kolob. You know, I think we've pretty well identified Kolob at this point and explained how it is nearest to the throne of God. And then, you know, the rest of the verses here, verse 4 through verse 10, are about time dilation. How many have seen the movie Interstellar? Great science fiction movie. Interstellar offers a perfect model for these scriptures in Abraham. The story is fictional, of course, but the science is real. In fact, the science advisor and co-producer of the film was Kip Thorne, who is a Nobel laureate physicist at Caltech. And, you know, his goal was to make a movie that was scientifically accurate. In fact, he wrote this book that he wrote called The Science of Interstellar, in which he explains all the science in the movie. So it's a little bit, you know, some of the things are a little bit abstruse, you know, a little bit difficult to understand, but but it's there. Anyway, if you've seen the movie, you've already had an introduction to time dilation. So, I keep forgetting to change the thing here. So in the movie, a team of astronauts and scientists travel to a planet near one of these supermassive black holes in another galaxy. The name of it is Gargantua in the movie. And to their experience, time is passing normally. And of course, back home on Earth, time is passing normally for them also. But relative to each other, there's a huge difference in elapsed time. So they're in a rush to get back home because actually gravity slows down time. So, so we're going to use the movie as a model for what's going on in Abraham chapter 3. So in the movie, 1 hour near Gargantua equals 7 years on Earth. And if we calculate the ratio, the time dilation factor, 7 years divided by 1 hour, we get 61,362. So time is passing 61,362 times as fast on the Earth as it is on Gargantua. So if you're watching, let's say you're watching an NFL game from Gargantua, which is impossible, but, you know, we can pretend. So you're watching an NFL game being played in the Superdome in New Orleans, let's say, my hometown, from a location in Gargantua. You'd see it last. A Super Bowl you know, an NFL game lasts 60 minutes, not counting halftime and, you know, timeouts and all that. So 60 minutes, which is 3,600 seconds. So dividing 60 seconds by 61,362, we get that the Super Bowl, you'd see the Super Bowl last for 6 hundredths of a second. You know, you'd be pretty disappointed. So we can say the reckoning of the earth's time is not so many as to its number of days and of months and of years relative to the passing of time on this planet near the supermassive black hole, Gargantua. So Gargantua is bigger than the earth, more massive, so its gravity is greater than the earth. The earth is bigger than the moon. So earth time is to Gargantua time, or Kolob time, as moon time is to earth time. So this slide has pretty much everything you need to know to understand these verses in Abraham, which I claim are about time dilation. All right, so let's look at Abraham. So verse 4 says, "And the Lord said unto me by the Urim and Thummim that Kolob was after the manner of the Lord, according to its times and seasons and revolutions thereof. That one revolution was a day unto the Lord, after his manner of reckoning, it being 1,000 years, according to the time appointed unto that whereon thou standest. This is the reckoning of the Lord's time, according to the reckoning of Kolob. In our interstellar model, 1 hour on a planet near Kolob equals 7 years of earth time. So similarly, 1 day of Kolob time equals 1,000 years of earth time. It fits the model." So that verse fits the model. So it's about time dilation. Verse 5, And the Lord said unto me, the planet which is the lesser light, lesser than that which is the rule of day, even the night, is above or greater than that upon which thou standest in point of reckoning. For it moveth in order more slow. This is in order because it standeth above the earth upon which thou standest. Therefore, the reckoning of its time is not so many as to its number of days and of months and of years. Okay, so what does it mean that the moon stands above the earth? It means it orbits the earth. It's up there. And we calculated, remember, just a couple minutes ago, we calculated the Super Bowl lasted 6 hundredths of a second if we're watching from Gargantua. That would be our experience. So since the moon is to the earth as the earth is to Gargantua, the reckoning of the moon's time is also not so many as to its number of days and of months and of years relative to the earth. It's the same principle, although the effect is smaller because the difference between the earth's gravity and the moon's gravity is a factor of about six. But between Gargantua and the earth, it's trillions. So the effect is much smaller between the earth and the moon. But it's the same principle. So it fits the model again. In verse 6, "And the Lord said unto me, Now Abraham, these two facts exist. Behold, thine eyes see it. It is given unto thee to know the times of reckoning and the set time, yea, the set time of the earth upon which thou standest, and the set time of the greater light, which is set to rule the day, and the set time of the lesser light, which is set to rule the night." So what is set time? Well, there's an exact parallel in physics. It's called proper time. And the definition of proper time is time as measured by a clock moving with the observer, which in So, I'm used to having a clicker, you know, just. In relativity, in physics, set time is called proper time and is defined as time as measured by a clock moving with the observer, which includes, you mean you could be standing still, right? If you're in a gravitational field, though, you are moving according to Einstein because gravity gravity is actually equivalent to, well, it's an acceleration, really. So it's movement. If you were free falling, no, you know, then it's not the same. But if you're standing, we're all sitting or standing in here, we're all accelerating. So two observers in different gravitational fields or in relative motion will measure different intervals of proper time between any two events. So again, it fits the model. It fits what we know from physics, precisely. Verse 7. Now the set time of the lesser light is a longer time as to its reckoning than the reckoning of the time of the earth upon which thou standest. So, remember, 1 hour near Gargantua equals 7 years on earth. The earth's time was a longer time as to its reckoning. So again, the moon is to the earth is to Gargantua. Therefore, the set time of the moon is a longer time as to its reckoning than the reckoning of the earth. Again, it fits the model exactly. Verse 8, and where these two facts exist, there shall be another fact above them, that is, there shall be another planet whose reckoning of time shall be longer still. What two facts? Well, the fact of one planet orbiting another with their relative reckoning of time, and then another fact above them means a third planet in a higher orbit, right, than the first orbiting planet. And, of course, the second orbiting planet has a longer reckoning of time than the first orbiting planet, because it's further away from the orbited planet. It's farther away from that larger gravitational field, right? So there you go. Time relation again. And it fits just perfectly. All right. Slide 23. And this is really interesting here now. It's easy to miss the meaning of these two verses, 9 and 10. And thus there shall be the reckoning of the time, one planet above another, until thou come nigh unto Kolob, which Kolob is after the reckoning of the Lord's time, which Kolob is set nigh unto the throne of God to govern all those planets which belong to the same order as that upon which thou standest. And it is given unto thee to know the set time of all the stars that are set to give light, until thou come not near unto the throne of God. Well, let's say, you know, most of these verses so far are talking about relative set times, right? So, but, you know, let's say we're building a house and the house plans say board B should be twice as long as board A. That's not enough information, is it? You have to relate the lengths of the boards to a standard that's known with precision, usually feet and inches, right, in the United States anyway. So that's what these two verses do. So we can actually calculate the set time of the Earth relative to Kolob based on the information in verse 4. There are 365,000 Earth days to a Kolob day, 1,000 years multiplied by 365 days per year, right? So the set time of the Earth is 365,000 Kolob days. That's the set time of the Earth according to verse 4. So, in order for Abraham to, it says that it's given unto Abraham to know the set times of all the stars and planets. Not relative to each other, but the actual set times. So, to know the set times of every star and planet in the Milky Way, the set times of each one would have to be related to a standard, and the obvious standard is a Kolob day, a one revolution of Kolob, which it tells us, you know, way back in verse 4. So, until thou come near unto the throne of God, or Kolob, includes Kolob time in this system of relative times, and relates the set times of the stars and planets ultimately to Kolob, which sets it as the standard. So, that's what these two verses mean. And then, finally, how are we doing on time?
We got about 16 minutes, and we want to get some Q&A.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. That. Okay, so, thus I, Abraham, talked with the Lord face to face as one man talketh with another, and he told me of the works which his hands had made. And he said unto me, My son, and his hand was stretched out, behold, I will show you all these. And he put his hand upon mine eyes, and I saw those things which his hands had made, which were many, and they multiplied before mine eyes, and I could not see the end thereof. You know, I've given this talk several times before, and usually somebody will come up to me afterwards and say, well, if every galaxy has its own collab, does that mean that every galaxy was created by a different creator? And I believe these two verses right here anticipate that very question. And the answer is no. Because Abraham obviously saw many, many galaxies. Right? And they were all created by God, the God of this universe. So, and they all relate to the same reality. I mean, to the same, they all lead to the same alternate reality, which is where the throne of God is located. And then I had somebody say, well, but the galaxies are so far apart, so how can that be? But the thing is, time and space are features of this universe, our three-dimensional, four dimensions if you count time, our four-dimensional space-time universe. And when you're out of it, all bets are off. You know? In fact, it can be shown, I mean, it's very simple algebraic equation to calculate the distances, times and distances that are seen by light. And it turns out that anything that travels at the speed of light, you know, as you approach the speed of light, time and distance go to zero. And there's only one thing that travels at the speed of light, and that's light. So light sees no time and no distance. And really, we are beings of light. Our spirits are, that's something for another presentation. But anyway, I think you get my point. That it doesn't matter how far apart the galaxies are in terms of our universe. They all lead to the same place. They're supermassive black hole at the center. Okay, so here are a couple of quotes by some well-known scientists. Einstein said, science without religion is lame, and religion without science is blind. And President Nelson said, there is no conflict between science and religion. Conflict only arises from an incomplete understanding of either science or religion, or both. You know, you probably know, President Nelson is an MD, PhD, and one of the developers of open-heart surgery. I consider him a scientist. And that brings us to the end here. As I said, I guess I didn't exactly say it, but I have assigned myself the mission of teaching this, exactly what President Nelson says here. And so that's the mission that I have assigned myself. And so I will just mention my book. And, you know, to me, science is the future of faith. You know, the future of faith is being the theme of the symposium. Science is the future of faith, in my opinion. And I think when people realize this, it will become a reality. So you can download this paper. In fact, I'm presenting two papers today. There's another one on science in the light of Christ in the book of Genesis. I'll be presenting this afternoon. You can download both papers at my website here, light-of-christ.com, if you'd like. And if you want to take a look at the book, it's right over here in the benchmark book place down here. So, and that's it. I'll take some questions now. Thank you.
Thanks so much for your presentation. I hope this makes sense. So when you do the math, when you find out that one day on Kolob is 1,000 years here, uh-huh. if you do the math, does it work out to whereas the size of Kolob works out to be about the size of Sagittarius A? So because I know you said when things slow down, it's because it's bigger, right? time-wise?
Time slows down in a gravitational field, and the bigger the gravitational, the more intense.
The slower it is, right? So if you work that out so that 1,000 years here is one day there, does the size of Kolob work out to be about what the size of Sagittarius A is? Does that make sense?
I have read what the size is. I'm not sure I remember, but it's something like the size of this. I think it was about the size of the solar system.
Okay.
Yeah, it's big.
And so then the set time there would be about like the one day to 1,000. That ratio would be about right, do you think?
You're asking me if I calculated the time dilation based on the size of Sagittarius A. No, I have not.
Okay. Yeah, that's what I was asking.
No, I would have to look that up. Okay. I don't know how to do it, but it can be done.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Let me ask you a question which puzzles me.
Sure.
If there are more than one Kolob, right?
Yes.
And each Kolob represents a galaxy of planets, which is probably populated.
Every galaxy has a, if you want to call them a Kolob, yeah.
In your mind, are those galaxies populated with people? And if so, the religious question is the atonement of Christ applicable to those in other galaxies governed by Kolobs?
Well, I would say yes. Probably every galaxy, we're talking about billions of stars typically, and many of them have, habitable planets. How the atonement of Christ relates to every galaxy, I do not know. I have thought about that, many people have thought about that, and nobody has an answer to that I'm aware of.
I just want to jump in on that.
Sure.
John Taylor in the book Kingdom of God says that, and also in the Atonement, his book on the Atonement,
okay,
he talks about Christ being the Savior of 12 different places, planets or I believe probably galaxies, and that the Atonement covers all of those. So take that for what it's worth, but that has actually been articulated by John Taylor in his writings.
Okay. Yeah, the thing is, though, that there are billions of galaxies out there. We nobody knows how many. There may be an infinite number. If the universe is infinite in size, which scientists don't know whether it is or not, there's different theories about it. But if it's infinite, then there's an infinite number of galaxies out there. So, and if there are an infinite number of galaxies out there, then why did he come to this earth, to make the atonement?
And it goes one step further. Can there be more than one Christ, one for each galaxy?
Yeah, so, he showed Joseph Smith all the works of his hands, and they obviously included many galaxies. So maybe he can be in more than one place at one time. There are mystics who claim that is possible, for extremely advanced people who are extremely advanced spiritually. I don't know. I've always been in one place at one time, as far as I can remember. So who knows? I don't know. Those are interesting questions, very interesting questions that I don't know the answer to, frankly. Maybe nobody does.
Just two questions. The first is, when we're talking about great stars in the Book of Abraham, how do we know that that's referring to black holes rather than just stars in general?
Well, the black holes are the biggest stars. So I think we can assume. It's an assumption.
Okay, yeah, so you're assuming that great would be referring to a massive massive black hole? Is that what you're assuming?
All black holes are... they're typically 25 to 40 times bigger than our sun in terms of mass. So, they're and they can be unlimited in size, although there are very, very few, maybe one or two, intermediate size black holes that have been discovered, a few hundred times bigger than a typical black hole. But there's only one per galaxy, that's a supermassive black hole. And I think the definition of it is a black hole that's at least a million solar masses, a million times the mass of our sun.
Okay. And then the second question is, and I'm making sure I understand this because I'm definitely not a physicist. You said that with three-dimensional beings, we can't enter through a black hole, correct?
Oh, we could fall into one, but, you know, you die.
So how does that account for a resurrected being? Like, how would a resurrected being be able to then transport in and out of a black hole with the three-dimensional limitations?
My opinion is that, you know, Christ, when he came down to, you know, and I'll be talking about this in this afternoon a little bit, about Genesis. My opinion, he comes down as, you know, unembodied, and then he can take on physicality when he gets into our universe. But that's just my opinion, okay? Maybe he has no trouble just coming. I don't know if he comes in the same way we go out. It would seem reasonable, though, that, you know, that he would. So
you're saying it's possible that he could disembody and then re-embody as he's traveling back and forth? Is that what I'm understanding?
I mean, yeah. I mean, that's just an idea that I have. May or may not be correct.
Right, okay.
But you know, even if he comes bodily through, you know, being a resurrected being, it's not going to hurt him. You know?
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay, I have two questions. One's kind of just off topic a little bit about the astronauts that landed on the moon. They were wearing Omega watches. Do we know anything about what their watches said relative to, and they were projecting video back to the Earth as well, right? So anyway, food for thought on that.
Can I address that just very quickly?
Yeah.
The difference between the Earth's gravity and the moon's gravity is only a factor of about 6.
Right.
So over an hour, the time we talked about Super Bowl lasting an hour, over an hour, the difference in elapsed time would be in the microseconds.
Okay. So they were on the moon for 2 hours and whatever minutes, like 2 hours and 30 minutes. So curious if their watch was off by a second or two.
No, but I can tell you, one of the systems I worked on before I retired from engineering was the latest generation GPS system. And there's clocks aboard the GPS satellites have to be precisely synchronized with clocks in your receiver on the ground. Otherwise, the positioning would be off so much that after, you know, just a little while, the system would be unusable. So they're designed, the clocks aboard the satellites are designed to run a little bit slower than normal so that when they're at altitude, they will be precisely synchronized with the clocks and receivers on the ground. See, your receiver knows where it's at. I mean, it's several satellites, 3 or 4 satellites, and it's triangulated, but it knows the difference. It knows the distance to each one because the satellite sends a time signal, a time stamp, you know, down to the ground, and the receiver on the ground knows how long it took to get from the satellite to the receiver on the ground, so it knows the distance. Knowing the time tells it the distance, how far away it is, so that's how it works.
Okay.
But at altitude, the clocks run a little bit faster. I mean, they would run a little bit faster, so they're designed to run a little bit slower than they normally would.
Okay.
Compensate.
Thank you. So my real question is, I'm still caught up on the whole black hole thing. If I'm understanding, so correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I'm understanding you're saying the black hole, Sagittarius A star, is a black hole, and it is Kolob.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you reconcile that with Joseph Smith's description of Kolob? And I don't remember where it is, whether it's in DNC or a talk he gave or whatnot, but as being a sphere of glass.
Oh, was he talking about Kolob, or was he talking about... Kolob,
I thought he was talking about God lived on Kolob, which was like a sea of glass, and that this earth would then become like that. But
I know he talked about...
Kolob, not Kolob itself.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Give him a good hand.